Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. Today, 2 days before the election, we'll examine the latest polls in the key battleground states that will likely determine the outcome of this presidential election, as well as which party ends up controlling the Senate. We'll begin with Florida and Ohio that appear to cancel each other out in the sense that Trump will likely take Ohio and Hillary Clinton Florida, thus making North Carolina and Pennsylvania the deciding states, which we'll also look into along with Arizona. Peter Brown, the assistant director of the Quinnipiac Polling Institute, where he is the chief spokesman for the Florida and Ohio polls, joins us to discuss the latest numbers in both Florida and Ohio and the less than stellar candidates the Democrats put up against vulnerable Republicans, with former Democratic governor of Ohio, Ted Strickland, blowing his lead over Rob Portman, and Patrick Murphy failing to unseat a very beatable Marco Rubio. Then we'll discuss how North Carolina is shaping up as the key swing state with Jonathan Wyler, the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, who also writes for Durham, North Carolina's Independent Weekly. We'll discuss the status of rampant GOP voter suppression efforts in the state, the close Senate race, and how much the evangelical zeal of the bathroom-obsessed governor is backfiring in his race and others across the state. Then we will analyze the races for president of the U.S. and Senate in Pennsylvania with Dr. Terry Madonna, director of the Franklin and Marshall College poll, who's also a pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and many other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania. With both candidates having spent more time in the state than any other, we will look into the rural-urban divide and assess the key Senate race in which the very conservative Republican Senator Pat Toomey is neck and neck with the Democrat Katie McGinty, who might not have been the best choice to challenge such a vulnerable senator. Then finally, with the Supreme Court just handing the Republicans a victory in Arizona by reinstating a state law that restricts the collection of ballots by third parties and advocacy groups, limiting the collection of early ballots from voters and their delivery to election officials, we will speak with Evan Wyloge, an investigative reporter with the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, who was previously with the Arizona Capital Times. He joins us to also discuss the GOP's poll monitoring plans in the state and the political fate of Donald Trump's controversial buddy, Sheriff Joe Arpaio. And joining us now is Peter Brown, who's the assistant director of the Quinnipiac University Polling Institute, where he is the chief spokesman for the Florida and Ohio polls. He has more than 30 years of experience as a political journalist and editor in Washington, D.C., New England, and Florida, and previously was a political reporter for United Press International. He also served as a White House correspondent and then political editor for Scripps Howard News Service in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Brown.
Thank you.
And Peter, what's the latest on these two critical states of Ohio and Florida that you're watching? Pretty much, as far as I can tell, the polls are even. Both are critical. If Donald Trump loses Florida, he apparently loses the election. So that makes it obviously extremely important. What's the latest?
Well, there are a bunch of polls out. We had one we released last week, at the end of the week, that showed Mr. Trump up 5 points in Ohio and down 1 point in Florida. The other state that people need to look at that's actually become critical importance is North Carolina. Mr. Trump, in a number of polls, has had a lead in Ohio recently, so much of the attention that normally goes to Ohio has been diverted towards North Carolina, which is, you know, running neck and neck at this point. It is a good analysis that Mr. Trump can't win without Florida and Florida and North Carolina.
So why did North
Carolina? But frankly, it would be very difficult for Mrs. Clinton to win without those two also.
So why did North Carolina become important?
It became important because it changed its political voting. 10 years ago, it was a solidly Republican state. Not so much anymore. It does have a Republican governor who is up for re-election and is fighting for his political life. And it's a state that has been Republican for many decades until the last few years. Mr. Obama carried it the first time, but not the second time he ran for for the presidency. The state has changed a bit. The Raleigh-Durham area is especially vibrant economically. There's been lots and lots of in-migration. The state is not what it once was. It's not Tobacco Road anymore.
So what do you detect in terms of the swing, which seems to have happened since the Comey letter from the head of the FBI? I'm not sure about what it's had in terms of polling, but I think you can fairly say that it's given Donald Trump a kind of second wind here. He seems to, he was in the doldrums and quite, you know, depressed, it seemed, almost facing an inevitable loss. And then suddenly this letter comes out, and now he's out campaigning. He's doing four states today. He's on a, he feels like he's on a roll, and you can see the spring in his step as opposed to the despondency that he had prior to that letter. So am I to conclude that it's had that kind of an effect?
Well, it's not clear to me that it had a completely controlling effect. It is true that Mr. Trump is doing better since that letter, but it was also true that he was in the middle of, or the beginning parts of something of a comeback. Secretary Clinton's lead had been shrinking in some polls, and that, and the, obviously the FBI incident has had an effect. I mean, the election is a virtual tie.
So what are the factors then in the wild card factors in Florida? My understanding is that the Latino vote is way up there, and it normally, it used to go to the Republicans, particularly with the dominance of Cuban Americans. That's apparently faded over the last decade or so. And you also,
We'll see. I mean, it's not clear. It certainly hasn't been true in past elections that it's been as big as some are predicting it will be.
But this year, there are reports that there have been record numbers of Latino voters.
There have been reports. The question is, do the people actually show up?
Right.
The people say a lot of things, especially as you get closer to an election. But we don't really know.
Right.
We find those things out in what's called exit polls.
Right. By which time
it's too late.
So what's happening then with Rubio? It's a strange twist there where the Democrats suddenly pull their money from the Democratic challenger to Rubio and then reinstated the money. And my understanding is that Rubio has a slight edge, but he is beatable.
I would not suggest you want to bet your mortgage on that one.
Uh-huh. So
our poll that we released on, it's Friday, had Rubio up 50-44. So he's up 6 points at that point with 5 days to go. History is not replete with lots of examples where that happens.
Right. No, you definitely...
which is not to say that there's not a chance that Mr. Murphy can win. There's certainly a chance, but six is a lot of points.
So let's turn to Ohio then. It's always said that if you don't win Ohio, you don't win the presidency.
Well, no Republican has ever won the White House without carrying Ohio. That's
right.
For sure.
So, in effect, Donald Trump's in double jeopardy. If he doesn't win Florida, he doesn't win the White House. And if he doesn't win Ohio, he doesn't win the White House. Is that right?
That's correct. And if he doesn't win either Pennsylvania or North Carolina, it's difficult for him to win the White House. Possible, but difficult.
So, what if, for example, the governor, I understand, Kasich, who ran against Trump and clearly wasn't happy with the way that the primaries worked out, particularly the tone of them, since he tried to appeal to the better angels. I understand he voted for John McCain. So
That's what he says.
Yeah, so he's a popular governor. What's the latest there in terms of your polling?
As I said, our last poll, which we released on Thursday, had Mr. Trump up 5 points over Secretary Clinton.
So is there any way that she can catch up? The Democrats supposedly have the great ground game, and that certainly came out in 2012. It caught Romney by surprise. He actually thought he'd won the election, but for the fact that the Democrats had such a good ground game in Ohio. That's my memory of 2012. Does that gel with yours?
Not completely, but go ahead.
Well, the question would be then, what can the Democrats do to pull it out at the last minute?
They keep campaigning. And I again, 5 points is a lot of points in the last 5 days.
Right.
And certainly the Democrats have not abandoned Ohio. But there seems to be a feeling on both sides that, you know, Ohio is Trump's best state among the what have been considered the big four: Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina. And certainly, Trump did it without help from the governor's organization. On the other hand, Rob Portman, who is the state's junior U.S. senator, who is up for re-election on Tuesday, is going to win by double digits in all likelihood. And he has a pretty good operation, and he's the name that's on the ballot, not Kasich.
So. Right. But is that attributed to the fact that the former governor of Ohio, Ted Strickland, just sort of was a washout?
Mr. Strickland had an early lead, early like a year and a half ago when this campaign started, and he was a bright spot for Democrats because Portman was an incumbent high on their target list. Didn't work out that way. Portman, our last polls have had him ahead double digits. Other people's polls have had him ahead double digits. Mr. Strickland has not done all that well, and
right.
You know, for whatever reason. Interestingly, Mr. Strickland had an early lead because he was better known than the incumbent he was running against. He was running against an incumbent U.S. senator, and he was better known to Ohioans, our polling showed, was the Republican candidate. But Portman ran a pretty good campaign, and after time, he just wore Strickland down.
Well, the ground game, though, that was attributed to the 2012 win by the Democrats that allegedly caught Romney by surprise, that's been reported a lot, that the Democrats have an advantage on the ground game that Trump never...
There is a belief that that's correct, yes.
Right. Do you think that's going to apply in Ohio, or is it? Are they just the 5 points is insurmountable?
You never say never.
Right. So when you talk about these candidates that the Democrats chose, particularly in these key states, to get back the Senate, because that's in many ways as important as the presidency. It certainly will impact Hillary Clinton's presidency if she's to win. If she doesn't control the Senate, we'll have another 4 years of gridlock, and she won't be able to appoint.
You're almost certainly going to have a Republican House.
Right.
So.
But why didn't they run better candidates? I mean, McGinty's not, she's, I think, ahead in Pennsylvania, but not doing that well. And then again, the former governor in Ohio, I guess he just didn't step up. He was accused of being sort of too old, I take it. There was ageism came into it. I'm not sure whether that was the main factor. But is this a case where the Democrats just don't have a deep bench?
Well, they've had problems finding good candidates. When Kasich got reelected governor in 2014, his opponent was a prosecutor from the Cleveland area who had limited political experience, and he didn't. The challengers didn't do very well. Kasich got elected well with over 60% of the vote, and the DGA pulled its money early in that race.
Well. Just in closing then, Peter Brown, the two states that you're chief spokesman for the Quinnipiac poll, Florida and Ohio, both critical states, both particularly for Donald Trump. One of them is up for grabs, Florida.
Oh, they're both up for grabs.
Both up for grabs, but there's a slight, it looks a little better for the Democrats in Florida, but not in Ohio. It looks a little better for the Republicans in Ohio.
Right, but again, North Carolina is kind of, come in there in terms of priority. North Carolina is a very big deal.
And that and you don't have any predictions on that one?
Well, we had, as I said, we had a poll that came out at the end of the week that had Secretary Clinton up 3 points.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Peter Brown.
No problem.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Brown, who's the Assistant Director of the Quinnipiac University Polling Institute, where he's the chief spokesman for the Florida and Ohio polls. He has more than 30 years of experience as a political journalist and editor in Washington, D.C., New England, and Florida. Previously, he was a political reporter for United Press International, and he also served as a White House correspondent and then political editor for Scripps Howard News Service in Washington, D.C. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing how North Carolina is shaping up as the key swing state.
Don't need to change the futures are. You don't need to change.
Oh, give us your vote. Give us your vote.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jonathan Weiler, who is the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. He's the director of global studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he also writes for Durham, North Carolina's Independent Weekly. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Weiler.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
And we've just been told by the Quinnipiac pollster that North Carolina is shaping up as the key swing state in this election, with, in effect, Florida and Ohio canceling each other out, likelihood of Hillary Clinton winning in Florida and Donald Trump winning in Ohio makes North Carolina the deciding state. Is that the impression that you have there in North Carolina?
Well, certainly, Ian, if you judge by how often the candidates and their surrogates are visiting the state, North Carolina certainly seems to be ground zero. We've had Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and their, well, and especially on Hillary's side, surrogates in and out of the state constantly over the past 2 months. And in fact, Hillary Clinton's final campaign stop of the campaign will be a midnight rally in Raleigh, North Carolina, Monday night. So there's no doubt it's ground zero for the campaign.
So let's talk about the other big factor in this race, and that is the Senate. If Hillary Clinton is to win the presidency, if she doesn't to win the Senate, there'll be four more years of total gridlock, and the Republicans have already made it clear that they may not allow her to put anybody on the Supreme Court. So after 4 years of misery, we may end up with a Supreme Court of six or seven justices. Not a very happy prospect. So how is that key race going there in North Carolina with the woman from the ACLU, who seems like a really interesting fresh face in politics, and of course, Senator Burr, the chairman of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, who is behaving in a most outrageous way by not acknowledging the intelligence community's concerns about Russia's interference in this election to help Trump. So he's proving to be an absolute disgrace, whereas Deborah Ross seems like a promising change in politics.
Yeah, so the Burr-Ross race is a really interesting race. Senator Burr is a two-term incumbent. He's not especially popular, but he's also not as toxic as some other Republicans in North Carolina are this year. And he's running against Deborah Ross, who's a relative unknown. She was a state senator and, as you said, an ACLU lawyer. And, you know, it's interesting, Ian, because one reason she won the nomination is because more prominent Democrats decided not to get into the race this year. And the reason they decided not to get into the race was because, you know, a year ago when people are making their plans, no one really expected North Carolina to be especially competitive for Burr's seat. But because of the way things have shaped up, the general unpopularity of Republicans in North Carolina, I think Trump has been a down drag on the Republican ticket in North Carolina. Ross is relatively unknown, has proven to be very competitive. So all the polling shows an extremely close race. And I think she is going to be very dependent on how well the top of the ticket, namely Hillary Clinton, does in North Carolina. If Hillary, if the race is close to a dead heat between Hillary and Trump, I'm not sure Ross has enough name recognition on her own to win. But if Hillary wins the state by 3 or 4 points, that might be just enough to get Ross over the finish line.
So how much these two other factors, the wild card factors, one, GOP voter suppression, which the court struck down, but I understand at the local level there's a lot of mischief afoot, and two, this unpopular governor, this bathroom-obsessed evangelical governor in North Carolina, who's also running, and he's apparently neck and neck with his Democratic challenger, the Attorney General Roy Cooper. How does that, let's start with the governorship. Is McCrory a drag on the Republican ticket?
I do think overall McCrory does hurt the Republican, the ticket. He's been an unpopular governor, according to opinion polls, really since the day he took office. And HB2, the notorious bathroom law, has certainly been unpopular in the state. And, you know, it's not because everybody in the state of North Carolina is so excited about transgender rights, but the black eye that the state has received, the number of big businesses that have announced they're pulling out of the state because of HB2, of course, very significantly for North Carolina, the NCAA's decision to remove its basketball and other tournaments from the state. I think all of that has certainly been a negative for Republicans, or will be a negative for Republicans up and down the ticket. There was a hurricane here 3 weeks ago in the eastern part of the state. I think that has actually helped the governor to some degree because of the state's, you know, relief efforts in that part of the state. The polling has been close, but has shown Cooper with a pretty consistent lead. And so it looks like that's going to, we're going to be waiting a long time on election night to find out the result of that race. And in terms of the voter suppression issue, you know, it's been interesting, Ian, because the Republicans in the state legislature, you know, passed what Rick Hasen, the country's most prominent voting rights expert, described in 2013 as the worst voter suppression law since the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down that law a few months ago. Republicans in North Carolina have been fighting rear guard action since then to try to maintain as many obstacles, especially to minority and black voting, as possible. The good news is that as of the end of early voting yesterday, North Carolina had shattered all of its previous records. We've had 3.1 million people turn out to vote early this year. That's up from 2.7 million in 2012. The demographic composition of that turnout is not as good in 2016 for Democrats as it was in 2012. But it does seem like, despite Republicans' best efforts, we're headed for extremely robust turnout in North Carolina this year.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Wyler, the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. He's the director of Global Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he also writes for Durham, North Carolina's Independent Weekly. So the record turnout, though, I mean, we're always told throughout this election that the enthusiasm gap is favors the Republicans, that Trump's people are more fired up than Hillary's people. Is that reflected in North Carolina?
So it's a good question. I mean, I think the early voting is a mixed bag for Democrats. On the one hand, as I said, we've had record early turnout in North Carolina. Generally, Democrats like to see that number go as high as possible. On the other hand, as I said a moment ago, the demographic composition of that turnout is a little less favorable this year. In 2012, African Americans made up about 27% of the electorate that turned out to vote, including during early voting. This year, during early voting, African Americans made up about 22%. So it's obviously a drop off, although it's actually a bit higher than people thought they would turn out at, because obviously with Obama on the ballot, there was going to be a drop-off. Women so far have turned out at about 10 points higher than men, which we assume is going to be good for Hillary Clinton. So it's been an interesting and mixed bag. And, you know, Ian, I know you know this, all over the country, one of the striking things about the campaign this year is that one side is a very robust ground game, and the other side, as far as we can tell, has almost none. And that may be that that ground game is compensating to some degree for that enthusiasm gap that Democrats were worried about.
Well, my understanding is that North Carolina went way to the right, largely because of the deep pockets of a local multimillionaire, Art Pope, and that he helped get McCrory in, the evangelical who seems to be obsessed with bathrooms and has come up with this ridiculous law that basically you're going to have vigilantes, or you're going to have the entire law enforcement community having to waste time hanging out at bathrooms instead of going after criminals to check the IDs of people entering a bathroom. I mean, it's crazy. And so you'd think that there'd be enough pragmatism left in the state and in the country in general to recognize, one, it's not a good idea to have the entire politics of a state manipulated by one guy. We have it here in California. The two rich guys are trying to change the state. One has put up a ballot to extend the last-minute negotiations on bills by 72 hours to allow the lobbyists to get in and change things. And this is all being done in the name of you know, interest of the people, as opposed to the billionaire. And then the other guy is trying to block a measure of Governor Brown's, and particularly stop high-speed rail here in the state of California. So we're seeing that here. But the idea that one guy alone changes the entire politics of a state, and you end up with these wacko bathroom laws, you think that might raise a few eyebrows.
Well, yeah, a couple of things about that, Ian. The first is that concerning Art Pope, there's no question that he had an extraordinary influence on the 2010 midterm elections in North Carolina, when Republicans took control of both houses of the state legislature for the first time in a century. And then Governor McCrory won the 2012 election very easily over a very weak Democratic candidate. And, you know, what's interesting and frustrating about North Carolina is that the state government, as you say, has skewed so far to the right. But it obscures the fact that we are a really evenly divided 50-50 state. You know, in 2012, Republicans won 9 of the 13 House seats in North Carolina, in spite of the fact that more votes were cast for Democratic candidates for the House than for Republican candidates. And that's a function of gerrymandering and residential self-selection. And the problem has been even worse on the state legislative level. So in that regard, the right-wing politics of the state really don't well reflect how evenly divided public opinion is in the state. And I do think that that is having an impact on the state races this year. As I mentioned, I mean, you said it about the bathroom law. What's ridiculous about the bathroom law is that even its supporters acknowledge that the law is completely unenforceable. For the reason you said, because there's no way we can have state law enforcement standing by every bathroom and checking IDs to see who's what. And so it really was just a gesture toward the right. It was a miscalculation by the governor, who thought that in a very tough re-election, this would actually help mobilize his base voters, when what it's done is alienate a lot of North Carolina moderates who might be ambivalent about the law, but certainly don't like the fact that the state has become a pariah in all the ways that we've already talked about. So it's a very interesting and complicated state. And I think there's a lot of anger this year that North Carolina has had a long time, well-deserved reputation as a very moderate former Confederate state. And we no longer have that reputation. And there's no question that bothers a lot of people who are not necessarily liberal, but are not reactionary either.
Well, Jonathan Wyler, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Wyler, who's the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. He is the director of global studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he also writes for Durham, North Carolina's Independent Weekly. And joining us now are Dr. Terry Madonna, who's a professor of public affairs and the director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College, where he directs the Franklin and Marshall College poll. He's written extensively about voters and voting behavior and founded the Keystone Poll in 1992, the oldest survey produced exclusively in Pennsylvania, which was renamed the Franklin and Marshall College poll. He is the pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and many other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Terry Madonna.
Hey, thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And Terry, obviously Pennsylvania is a key state here, along with Florida and Ohio. There's a kind of wash there, it seems. There's a chance that Hillary Clinton will pick up Florida and Donald Trump will pick up Ohio.
Right.
But how much is Pennsylvania up for grabs?
Yeah, well, it's very much up for grabs. The latest averages show Clinton up about 2.5 percentage points. I want to quickly point out that for six straight elections, Pennsylvania has gone with the Democratic candidate. These have not been huge victories, meaning, you know, with the Democratic candidate getting 56, 60, you know, up to 60% of the vote, that's not occurred. Obama carried, you know, won this state with about 52 percentage points 4 years ago. 2.5% close. The reason the race is closed and gotten, you know, as tight as it has been largely three occurrences. One is the traditional galvanizing coming home effect that Republicans do during the last week, 10 days of a presidential election. Democrats do that earlier. The second, of course, was the email situation a week or so ago when the FBI Director James Comey notified members of Congress that he had reopened the Clinton email investigation. And the third factor was that Trump has not taken the spotlight off Secretary Clinton by, you know, to be candid, just saying something outrageous or by saying something controversial. So overall, the state, in theory, looks like it's still up for grabs. It's still probably and more likely to be won by Secretary Clinton. I'm not ruling out a Trump victory, but everything has to go right for Donald Trump. And we can talk about that if you want. And, of course, Secretary Clinton needs to do the very same thing with her voters. But let me make this point to show you the significance of the state. The candidates for president and vice president have been in Pennsylvania 59 times. That's, as far as I can determine, more times than previous presidential and vice presidential candidates have been in this state campaigning than any time, perhaps, in history.
And is there a simple way to describe the bifurcation of the state, Democrat versus Republican, rural for Republicans?
Yeah, I would call it light blue, as they use that terminology. Translation, it's more Democratic than Republican. The Democrats have about an 800,000 active voter registration edge. They've won six straight presidential elections, as I've indicated. But here's what's fascinating. In the last two midterm elections, 2014, 2010, just as we have seen nationally, the Republicans have gained enormous ground. They control both houses of the Pennsylvania legislature, 13 of the 18 congressional districts in this state. A lot of that is through artful gerrymandering. However, because of the reaction to the Republican governor, Tom Corbett, elected in 2010, he was defeated by Tom Wolf, a Democrat. So we have a Democratic governor, a Republican-controlled legislature, and a Republican-dominated congressional delegation.
But it's essentially rural-urban split, is it not? And at the end of the day, it will come down. Will it come down to the Democratic Party's ground game in the big cities?
That's one of the keys. But you're exactly right. Donald Trump's best area of support are in the rural areas, highlighted by the southwestern part of Pennsylvania and the northeastern part, where coal and iron and a coke and steel manufacturing were once the hallmark of the state's economy and a major part of the industrial revolution that helped America, regain its prominence in economic growth and development throughout the world. Let me put it another way. These voters that Trump has his best support among are white blue-collar workers without high school education. That's Trump's strongest support base. Now, conversely, Secretary Clinton's strongest support comes in the urban areas, as you indicated. So here's the way the race now shapes up. The battle is on for the Philadelphia suburbs, just as we have in the suburbs outside of Denver, just as we have in Virginia, with the suburbs outside of Washington, D.C., in Northern Virginia. One out of every five votes cast in Pennsylvania 4 years ago was cast in the voter-rich Philadelphia suburbs, four counties. They in the midterm elections, went Republican. In presidential elections, they have gone Democratic. Clinton holds the lead in large part because she's winning there among female voters and college-educated voters. And Trump needs to do better there if he wants to carry the state. Now, in addition to that, the Clinton campaign does have a concern about the turnout in the African-American community, and that's been widely discussed in the national media, and as well among millennial voters, 18 to 34-year-olds. Both of those gave Barack Obama a huge share of the vote, and the campaign, the Democrats, have been virtually living in urban Pennsylvania and as well on college campuses to make sure that the turnout is strong in those two areas. The colleges, over 100 colleges and universities in the state, third largest number in the country. So you can see why millennials, African Americans, about 30% of the total vote in the state are very important in this contest.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Terry Madonna, who's Professor of Public Affairs and Director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College, where he directs the Franklin and Marshall College Poll. He is the pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and many other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania and the key suburbs of Philadelphia that you mentioned, Terry. Of course, Melania Trump campaigned there the other day. Hillary Clinton was joined by Katy Perry at a concert in Philadelphia on Saturday night. Joe Biden, of course, was born in Pennsylvania, is crisscrossing the state. And Hillary Clinton on Monday, she'll finish her campaign at a big rally in Pennsylvania, which is where, of course, she accepted the party's nomination. And she'll be joined by her husband, of course, and President Obama and Michelle Obama. So they're pulling out all the stops.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, if you look at it, and I think you started out correct. I mean, you were absolutely right on when you said Ohio looks like it might go for Trump. We'll see what happens in Florida. If Clinton wins it, you can see how important Pennsylvania becomes. And then throw in North Carolina. So we have Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Florida, and Ohio. 82 of the 270 electoral votes in four states. For Trump, Pennsylvania becomes even more important. Should New Hampshire and Nevada, they are tight, typically Republican. Should those two states, or one of the two anyway, flip for Clinton, then Pennsylvania becomes absolutely essential. If Hillary Clinton wins Pennsylvania and Florida, boy, the road to the White House for Donald Trump becomes very, very difficult. He has to turn somehow, some way, states like Virginia, Wisconsin, Minnesota, in which the leads are 4 points or more, and that becomes a tougher challenge. So Pennsylvania, Florida, Ohio, and North Carolina might well hold the key to the next president of the to which candidate's the next president of the United States.
Well, just in the last few minutes, Terry Madonna, let's talk about the key Senate race where one of the more vulnerable Republicans, Senator Pat Toomey, is up against Democrat Katie McGinty. They're pretty much tied, although I understand that she may have a very slim, like, one-point lead. Where does that stand?
Yeah, again, you're exactly right. I mean, I would call it virtually dead even. She does have a slight lead, but nothing outside the margin of error of any poll. For Toomey, let's talk about Senator Toomey. Senator Toomey is a conservative senator, one of the most conservatives in the Senate. He broke, of course, with other conservatives on universal background checks. He has been, in a sense, a pretty independent. He goes where he wants to go on the issues, but he is a rock-ribbed conservative. Having said that, he has not endorsed Donald Trump. He has not said he won't vote for him. He hasn't said he will. He said, I'm not voting for Hillary Clinton. And that puts him on he's walking a tightrope between the Trump supporters, those white blue-collar workers, the core of Trump support, and, as we talked about a moment ago, the Philadelphia suburban voters. These, and they're, of course, tilting towards Clinton. So what he has to do is to appeal to particularly women, college-educated voters, but men and women in the Philadelphia suburbs, many of them college-educated, and at the same time win the white working-class voters, and without the endorsement of Trump. Now, some think that will help him. Others think, nope, he may not do as well, and some of the polls show him not doing as well among white working-class voters, but in portions of the state, but doing better in the Philadelphia suburbs. So that's going to be an interesting battle. It could be a long night while the vote counting goes on. And McGinty has lined up solidly behind Clinton. That was early on in the campaign. There's no doubt about where she stands. She's pretty much a conventional Democrat, liberal on a lot of things, not on everything, to be sure. But she's a solid Clinton backer and has been there. They have campaigned together throughout the state. She's been held no public office, elected public office before, although she's done a lot of work in government. She worked for Al Gore, Bill Clinton, and lately she was chief of staff to Governor Tom Wolf for about 6 months until she left that job to run for the U.S. Senate post. Right down to the wire.
Well, just in closing, Governor Ted Strickland in Ohio turned out to be a bit of a dud for the Democrats, and Katie McGinty's not caught on fire. Did they make a mistake? Should they have run Admiral Joe Sestak?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, Joe Sestak's not to put it bluntly, not the darling of the Democratic Party. He ran against Arlen Specter when Specter changed his party to get elected to, the first time when he lost to Pat Toomey. He did defeat Specter in the Democratic primary in 2010, and the Democratic establishment lined up behind Specter. Imagine that. They lined up behind a five-term Republican senator as opposed to somebody in their own party. He's dissed the party. I'm talking about Sestak. He's not a favorite. He has no time for them. He's been openly critical of some of the leaders. Maybe you could look into the general election and see Sestak doing better. But you are correct. McGinty's not caught on in the way that you might have suspected. And, maybe there are three or four other Democrats we could talk about that might have put up a more formidable opponent against Senator Toomey.
Well, Dr. Terry Madonna, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Terry Madonna, who's a professor of public affairs and the director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College, where he directs the Franklin and Marshall College poll. He is the pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and many other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania. And we're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the GOP's poll monitoring plans in Arizona and the political fate of Donald Trump's controversial buddy, Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Evan Wyloge, who's an investigative reporter with the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, who covers politics and government in Arizona with a focus on watchdog data and accountability journalism. He previously spent 5 years as a reporter at the Arizona Capital Times. Welcome to Background Briefing, Evan Wyloge.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And Evan, the Supreme Court's decision on Saturday to reinstate the Arizona ballot collection law is seen as a victory for the Republicans. And it's difficult to get my head around the idea that there's something wrong with collecting ballots by advocacy groups and third parties to collect the early ballots from voters and delivering them to election officials. What is the objection there? I take it that process favored the Democrats. But what did the court find to be objectionable about it?
Well, so the timeline on this is that several years back, the local Democrats refined a tactic that turned out to be very useful for them. So they would go into neighborhoods that were very low efficacy neighborhoods, and where they also knew there were going to be a lot of Democratic votes. And they would walk door to door, sign people up for the early ballot system, where you would get your ballot in the mail several weeks before the election. And then they would enter this into a database so that they could come back and knock on the door when they knew that that ballot had been sent to that new voter. So they're signing people up. Then they go back once there's a ballot, and they ask them, hey, if you want to fill out your ballot now and I can turn it in for you, they'll let them do that. So that was really useful for the Democrats, and it helped get several people elected here, and the Republican-controlled legislature decided they didn't like it. So they wrote a law that outlawed that practice. So they call it ballot harvesting. They wrote the law, passed it this past legislative session. So now we have the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on Friday said that they wanted to put an injunction against the law. And on Saturday morning, the Supreme Court stayed the injunction. So we've been in a situation where we've, right here at the last minute, we've seen some flip-flopping on what exactly the law is going to be on Tuesday. So as it stands now, the new ballot harvesting ban is in effect, and so it's illegal to do that. There's another weird kink here, which is that for 18 hours there, between Friday, middle of the day, and Saturday morning, you had people saying that they were going to go out and do this. So go out into the neighborhoods, knock on doors, collect ballots. So now we've got people who we can assume did this just yesterday morning and the day before. So there's a whole lot of interesting things going on here.
Well, that sort of invites a lawsuit later on from the Republicans saying if the Democrats win, they say, well, these votes were illegally harvested. So what tell me, though, about the other thing that you've written about, Evan Wyloge, and that is Maricopa County GOP's plans for poll watchers. What's the status of that? Because the Democrats didn't get the dissent decree extended, the 1981 decree against the Republican National Committee for Organizing Voter Intimidation in New Jersey back in 1981.
Right. So the Maricopa County Republicans were telling their certified poll watchers, people there who are, that we allow one representative from each party at every polling location. So the Republican Party was telling their poll watching people that they were going to give a piece of paper that said that they're certified to be there, that they should, if they suspect somebody was doing the ballot harvesting like we were talking about, if that law specifically was being violated and they, you know, you see somebody bring in what they said was a bucket of ballots, then to go ahead and follow that person to their car, take photographs of them, take photographs of their car, and take photographs of their license plate. Now, the kind of clearest guidelines that have been provided by the courts on this matter specifically come from that consent decree that you're talking about from 1981 and 82. And so that was in New Jersey. So it's a federal court that told the RNC and the state of New Jersey, their parties as well. So all parties agreed to this consent decree saying that they would not participate in voter intimidation. In 2009, there was a clarification offered by the same court saying, don't photograph voters, don't photograph their vehicles. So, you know, you've got the Republican attorney saying that that consent decree doesn't specifically and per se bind Arizona. So it's not applicable. The Democrats who are worried about this say that actually it's pretty much what the courts would look to. It's what we have in terms of judicial guidelines on this matter. So if this is being done on Tuesday and something gets escalated or somebody's worried about what's going on, that could quickly turn into a lawsuit, I think, as well. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens on the ground here on Tuesday.
And again, I'm speaking with Evan Wyloszewski, an investigative reporter with the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, who covers politics and government in Arizona with a focus on watchdog data and accountability journalism. And he previously spent 5 years as a reporter at the Arizona Capital Times. So let's turn then to the issue of the controversial buddy of Donald Trump's, Sheriff Joe Arpaio, in Maricopa County again. Isn't he vulnerable this time? And I believe it's an Hispanic, isn't it, or Latino running against him?
His name is Paul Pinzone.
Right.
And he ran against Sheriff Arpaio back in 2012. Sheriff Arpaio essentially was the. He was Trump before Trump came along. He likes to say that he was Tea Party before that was cool. And he's been controversial for a long time. The immigration activists, which have really mobilized, and there was a kind of a turning point in 2006 with, you know, across the country, and particularly here, you know, starting in about 2008 and then even more with the passage of SB 1070. So you've got Hispanics and Latinos here locally who have mobilized over the past 10 years. And at the same time, I think you've got a lot of moderate conservative or moderate Republicans here in Maricopa County who think that the lawsuits that have been going on involving Sheriff Arpaio, the costs associated with those, that it's just time for somebody new. And we've seen his win percentage decline steadily for the past several elections. And I think the feeling here locally, the chatter among people who were working on campaigns and maybe privy to some more numbers internally, they think it looks pretty bad for Sheriff Arpaio this time around. He won last time with 50.7, I believe, percent of the vote in a three-way race. So that one's going to be maybe one of the biggest stories to come out of Arizona on election night, I think.
And is Pinzone a former sheriff or a law enforcement official?
I think he worked with the MCSO several years ago, so that's the sheriff's office, and I believe he also worked with Phoenix Police. I could be wrong about those details.
Right. But he's got a lot of support from, just in closing, isn't it, there are reports that there have been record turnout, or at least in terms of early voting with Latinos. Is that provable?
I've heard that. I've heard that as well. And I've spoken to some election officials who have the ability to, at least internally, do some surname analysis to see what they're getting back demographic-wise from these early ballots. And I think that they have confirmed that as well, at least. The one that I spoke with maybe about a week ago said that that's what he was seeing looking at this stuff. And I do think that the Arpaio vote is going to be more a referendum on Arpaio than anything else.
Well, just in closing, we started out talking about Florida and Ohio and then North Carolina and Pennsylvania, all of which are key swing states. Where does Arizona fit into this mosaic?
Well, I, if you look at the what the poll averages say right now, it looks like there's a small lead, maybe 4%, 5%. If you look at some others, for Trump to carry the state. Earlier, a couple weeks ago, the polls looked like it was neck and neck, 50-50. So we'll see. I think if things stabilize toward just the party registration figures, then it looks like Trump would take Arizona.
So does that mean that the Comey letter swung it back to Trump's favor?
Yeah, I mean, from what I can see, it looks like this Arizona is back in the red column.
And that would be the any other explanation apart from the Comey letter? That, I mean, I know they've both been campaigning there, but I'm just curious to get a...
I've got to think that things just look like they are normalizing to partisan, the regular partisan registration. If we, you know, it's a slight, it's, if you look at the two-party split in Arizona, it's about 54-46 favoring Republicans. And, you know, if we end up seeing something closer, a little bit narrower than that, then we'll be pretty close to registration.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Evan Wailosh.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Evan Wailosh, who's an investigative reporter with the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, who covers politics and government in Arizona with a focus on watchdog data and accountability journalism. And he previously spent 5 years as a reporter at the Arizona Capital Times. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.